Bat Segundo here, and there seems to be a false impression making the rounds. You see, certain parties have claimed that I, Bat Segundo, am not real. That I am pretending to be somebody else. That I am part of a reenactment, a persona, or a figment of your imagination, or perhaps a figment of mine. That I am a remainder from a bygone mass-market radio age inspired from the dregs, recesses and angry tears of a few hard and bitter investment bankers who wouldn't know fun even if limitless scoops of ice cream were crammed down their avaricious throats. Well, you can believe just about anything you want, but the truth of the matter here is that I am real, and the only reason I am here is for the tequila, which may explain why our young roving correspondent got so excited about Tom McCarthy.
Okay, so I am here with Tom McCarthy, who is the author of Remainder. Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm eating a really good rhubarb tart.
And the cappuccino, I should.
Latte.
Yeah. Oh, latte, not a cappuccino.
I should have been a cappuccino, it's true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, with the loyalty card in this, did you actually, like, get sick of cappuccinos? Is this your kind of testimonial as to being doped up on too many cappuccinos?
I didn't, my research didn't go to those lengths. That I didn't exactly do what the character does. I didn't drink as many cappuccinos as him.
How many cappuccinos have you actually imbibed in one time, I'm wondering?
I don't know, probably maximum four or something. So he's way ahead.
Yeah.
I think anyone that drinks that much cappuccino would go psychotic at some point.
Well, I mean, maybe we could start about this particular angle of the book. I have plenty of questions. This book sort of almost demands many questions. But I mean, this idea, drinking so many cappuccinos so as to wake oneself up, so desperate to, like, figure out what's going on to observe people that he feels the need to have, in one sitting, nine cappuccinos. This is,
Yeah, but the reason he has the nine cappuccinos isn't actually to stimulate his body. It's simply for the repetition. So he's found a store with a loyalty card scheme. So each time you get one, you get a thing, you get your thing stamped, and when you get 10, you get an extra one. And he's so fascinated with the idea of looping round, going through the zero, as he calls it, that he kind of drinks the nine in order to get that tenth one, that extra cup.
Yeah.
In fact, by the end of the book, he's buying nine at a time,
and
throwing them away just that he can get the extra, the remainder, you know, the leftover, the real one.
Well, yeah. Well, speaking of remainder, this title, I mean, it could be either the remainder of what's left over from this accident, or it could possibly be, if we were to use the mathematical division, what's left over, because this character constantly wants to have this extremely reductive, perfect notion of the universe. There's always a remainder. You can't divide every single digit into a whole number. So I wanted to actually ask you, did you design this book with the maximum number of interpretations imaginable? Because it could be interpreted so many different ways. At what point during the writing and planning of this novel did you kind of know that this was kind of a book that was just going to throw as many ambiguities out to the reader as possible?
Well, I didn't really plan it. It came by accident. The idea for the book came to me exactly the same way as it comes to the hero. I was at a party in a bathroom looking at a crack in the wall, and I had a moment of very strong déjà vu and remembered having been in a similar room with a similar crack on the wall, and this sort of composite memory came of cats on facing roofs and the smell of liver. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be good to kind of just, like, reenact this and reconstruct it and just move around it and look at it from the outside and, you'd need lots of money. How would you do that? And then I realized, oh, there's a novel right there. You know, and within half an hour, the whole set of, you know, just building out, unfolding that idea, as soon as you take it 2 degrees further, you get to quite violent and psychotic sort of possibilities, like, let's reenact a bank heist, let's make it as realistic as possible. Oh, let's really do it, but no one knows we're really doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Or they think we're really doing it, but actually we're reenacting it. So, I mean, straight away I kind of realized it had lots of allegorical, feet.
Yeah.
In it, that this was dealing with issues of memory, obviously authenticity, trauma, repetition, and power. I mean, it's very political, you know, the amount of control you need to exercise and the amount of violence you need to exercise. But, you know, I didn't set out thinking I want to write an allegory of power, control, violence, and memory and repetition. It was just kind of intuitive.
I'm wondering how many drafts you took for this particular thing, because the prose...
Three? It came pretty quick. I mean,
really?
It was pretty much all there in the first draft.
Wow.
I tweaked it no more in the second. In fact, it was two. I mean, the third was just a brush here and there. making sure I said phone box all the way through rather than phone box and phone cabin and phone booth. I mean, tiny things. It was kind of... I have this theory that books either come ready-made or they take a long time. I can imagine the sort of eureka moment, for example, for Ballard's Crash. You know, yes. I imagine he was just standing on a balcony looking at traffic, probably stoned, and suddenly had a vision of sex, death, and technology, and the whole book's there instantly, and the rest is just carpentry. Whereas something like, for example, Gravity's Rainbow by Pynchon, I imagine that took a really long time coming and probably came in bits and pieces. I mean, we don't know if this is true because Pynchon won't really talk about it. But, you know, I don't think one or the other makes for a better book, but I think you can really look at certain books and see that their genesis either was easy or slow.
Because it seems very extraordinary that there was only three drafts to get this, because the prose itself, it has this really illusory speed to it, in the sense that one reads it thinking, oh, well, this is a rather brisk read, and then you will introduce a sort of detail, like the weird guy at the bar,
where does it all go?
Where did he come from? So I'm wondering, in terms of, like, you know, really playing with the reader's perceptions of, oh, well, this is a fast read, even though there's a lot in here, and you have to kind of go back and see exactly what's set forth. I mean, was this very much in place early on? Or?
It fell into place really early on. I mean, as soon as the guy's voice came, and it came early because he's not an intellectual or an artist. He's just a very average, he's a Joe Schmo, he's some bloke, he doesn't even have a name. He's kind of an everyman. As soon as his voice was there, it just picked up its own rhythm, and then the set of sort of modulating repetitions and the phrases that come back, you know, they just suggested themselves. Once you get a certain amount of, it's like pinball. Once you go into multi-ball mode, they kind of stay up there for a bit. Do you know what I mean? And it just seemed to happen with this book.
So the momentum in this book, in writing it, came from these repetitive phrases, these incantations.
Yes, exactly. There's a sort of incantatory logic to it, a neurotic repetitiveness. And once that gets going, it kind of auto-repeats. It goes into autopilot mode of self-repetition, like which is the classical model of neurosis in Freud or whatever. You know, you can see that playing out rhetorically in the writing, in the text of this book, I think.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you about the time period of this book. You sort of make a few clues that it might be the late 90s. You have the rising telecommunications stocks, you have the Propeller Heads song, which I'm thinking like 1999 or something along those lines. You have the airport security being particularly lax, and I'm wondering why the late 90s time frame seemed to be the best to set this particular narrative.
It's pretty much when I wrote it. I wrote it from 2000 to 2001. In fact, I finished it just about a month before September the 11th, so it's kind of ironic. This book has been interpreted as an allegory of September the 11th, you know, or of US foreign policy. The hero starts out a victim of some sort of calamity, and he ends up as the perpetrator of other calamities, which is kind of, well, what the US has done, you know. But it's entirely accidental. I mean, it was all written before that. You're right. It did come out of that. I imagine it's kind of set during 99, 2000 as the stock market bubbles going up and then spectacularly bursting at the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, you even have this notion of this company, which is
Time Control
UK. Yeah. I mean, did this come about from the notion of all you had to do in that time period was essentially write out a 5-page prospectus and anyone would give you money? Or were there actually specific companies that you based Time Control UK on?
Oh yeah, and these concierge companies, you know, were just emerging in the UK, who will more or less do anything for you. They sort of live your life vicariously, or they script your life for you, which I just find, you know, kind of fascinating. I mean, it's quite kind of metaphysical, really. It's like, you know, you outsource your godliness, you outsource your autonomy, even though obviously you're paying them. And yeah, I mean, the stock market was I just found it really fascinating. This bubble and these companies that were just, you know, making paper millionaires out of people that had virtually no premise, like e-solutions. I mean, what on earth is that? You know, I read this article about the South Sea bubble of the 17th century, is it the 18th century, when stocks were going so high that people would throw money at anything, and there was a company called A Very Good Idea, Yet No One to Know What It Is, and its shares sold out in a day, and of course it went bankrupt in 6 months later. But it seemed to be a sort of... But I guess, you know, in this book, the movements of capital are very much tied in with the movements of everything else. So this idea of speculation, which has an astronomical meaning as well, contemplation of the heavens. And my hero spends a long time just looking at dust, constellations of dust suspended in a stairwell. And they're either going up or down. And the shares are doing the same thing. I mean, their speculation is about sort of, you know, projecting futures, keeping shares buoyant. And at the end, both the dust crashes and the shares crash and everything crashes. There's a sort of, you know, almost a cosmic coherence to the... So it's not really just a social take on the stock market. I mean, it's kind of using it to play out other concerns.
Well, it's also interesting because he also looks up at the subway ceiling at one point, and also he has his palms frequently upward. And how does this relate to the cosmological motif we're talking about here?
Well, he turns his hands outwards and gets this kind of levitation, this sense of levitation. It's also a kind of Christ-like thing, the stigmata. When the hero feels that he's somehow being more authentic, he gets almost this heroin-like, morphine-type hit of total authenticity and experience it as a sort of lightness and levitation. So, I mean, the book's really simple. Stuff goes up, stuff comes down, you know, be it matter, aeroplanes, or shares in the stock market, or indeed he himself.
Well, it's not just that, though. I mean, like, going to this idea of connecting with the world, early on in the book, you have his two friends, Greg and Catherine. And Catherine, he has this possibility of the last night in his flat. And there's a possibility that he could connect with her. So there's this particular moment that he decides to abandon for these great plans and these blueprints. And then the other major moment in which he actually tries to be empathic towards any of the other people, or is this invented moment with the homeless character. And so as a result, you read this book, and it's really rather astonishing to see just how little empathy he has, even for the poor pianist who just skips work one day to play the recording mangling Rachmaninoff. So what of this, is it more of a kind of concentration on empathy or a concentration on hidden economies?
It's the empathy thing. I mean, I did a lot of research into trauma and post-trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, as it's called now. In World War I, it was called shell shock. And one aspect of it that keeps coming up is this total lack of empathy with the world. There's a sort of disconnect, a radical disconnect from other people. Another thing that comes up is this propensity to repeat, to replay the moment of trauma, modulating it as it gets replayed. So the hero of Remainder has both of those symptoms, syndromes in spades. He's offered the possibility of connection with Catherine. I mean, sex, but it's more than sex. It would be a sort of psychological connection. And he deliberately cuts it at the vital moment because, as he says, he prefers her spectre. He'd rather have the world in absent form, in dead form. He'd rather have the simulacra of the world and of people than the world itself, in a way. I mean, the same with the homeless person, although I think, you know, the scene with the homeless person where he tells you that he kind of adopts this homeless person and takes him out for a meal and starts asking him, you know, what's your experience of sitting in the street and how real does it feel and so on. And then there are continuity mistakes in the account. Yeah. And then he says, oh, I've just been making all this up. Why should I have talked to him, this asshole? You know, I mean, he's really nasty. And in a way, I kind of did that to there's a certain Christian or post-Christian liberal model of empathy that I needed to rupture. I needed to trash in the book in order for him, for the hero, to do what he's going to do. So that homeless scene sets it up. Later in the novel, when he becomes obsessed with the death of a local drug dealer who was shot on a street corner near where the hero lives by another drug dealer. And the hero becomes so obsessed with this moment that he bribes police to give him the forensic report so he knows who went where, who fell where. He hires the stretch of street and reenacts this death again and again and again, as though it were a film set, but there is no film. In a way, that's... That's a model of empathy, and a much more interesting one to me. That would be the Levinasian model of empathy, speaking philosophically. Yeah. You know, I mean, for the philosopher Immanuel Levinas, ethics begins with trauma. And the ethical experience is an experience of sort of inhabiting the event field of trauma and of responding to a demand which is unfulfillable, a sort of opening yourself to some other in the past who maybe doesn't even have a name, but who is just sort of there. And my hero, for all that he's brutal and mean and is in fact quite a psychopath and yeah. ends up killing everyone, in that moment of reenacting again and again and again the moment of this other man's death, I think he's experiencing ethics in a very classical and profound way.
Yeah. The character of Nas, it was very interesting to me, and perhaps I just have a totally bizarre interpretation of this, but given the fact that his introduction comes after the homeless man, where he basically goes ahead and invents him, and then he says, oh yes, well, Nas is this guy who comes from a high-caste Brahmin family, but when Nas introduces himself at the cafe, he says, I'm Asian. And so part of me was thinking, oh, Axis in World War II. I mean, if you look at the reenactments, they're almost fascistic in some
yeah,
sense.
Totally,
and so
yeah.
I wanted to kind of ask you about these. And also, of course, we were talking about the loyalty card. Well, loyalty is very much in
yeah.
whatever time you're existing in, this yeah. time or in World War II, very much an idea of being a good patriot and a good
yes.
citizen. So
yeah.
so I'm wondering if 20th century history, how much of that was a prism with which to sort of contextualize the protagonist's
yeah.
many kinds of adventures here.
Yes, I mean, you know, to a large extent, the novel is an allegory of fascism, of two types of fascism, or of totalitarianism. The hero has a sort of aesthetic fascism. In literature, you find this played out in modernism. I mean, half of the great modernists were card-carrying fascists, from
yeah.
Yeats to Céline to Knut Hamsun to Ezra Pound.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, it goes on and on. Marinetti, you know, my God. On the other hand, Nas comes to embody a sort of Stalinist totalitarianism. I mean, he's obsessed with numbers and with making all the everything, all the systems work. And so killing 6 million kulaks to make the grain figures add up is a detail, as long as the figures add up. That's the kind of mentality Nas goes into. I mean, the name, another critic pointed out, you know, Nas plus I makes Nazi.
Yeah.
It's a complete accident. So, I mean, Nas is a... It's a kind of quite typical Indian name, like John or Chris for Caucasians. So, I mean, it was just it was kind of fortuitous. I mean, the whole idea of Nas being Indian originally came because I realized that the hero, in order to construct and carry out the elaborate set of reenactments that he wants to do, needs a right-hand man to organize it all. And I remembered in Moby Dick, Ahab, who has a similar obsession, has this sidekick who's this Asian character who's dark and swarthy. It's quite racist in a way. He's
yeah.
sort of in this
yeah.
romantic way embodies the darkness of, you know, of Ahab's
yeah.
white obsession. There's a wonderful scene when Ahab's eyes meet his in the water, and this is their sort of the triangle
yeah.
of their union. So I guess it just kind of, as soon as Nas was started forming in my mind, I guess he just was kind of Asian. And then I thought, well, modern India, it's all about, you know, call centers, logistics, data entry. I mean, this is where all of Europe and America outsources its logistics. You know,
yeah.
10 years ago it was Ireland, now it's India. So it kind of made sense that Nas would be Indian.
Well, I mean, one of the novel's central questions also, speaking of this fascistic idea, is how far are these reenactors going to go? How much will they be pushed before they actually say no? And the only real character, at least midway through the book, is this pianist we were talking about. Number of questions actually related to this figure. First of all, I'm wondering if there was any specific sort of literary character archetype for the bald pate and the sort of frizzy side things, because I could think of many possibilities here, but I was wondering if you had anything specific. And second, why did the pianist, perhaps by way of being a musician, is art perhaps the kind of counterpoint to fascism here?
He's the only one that resists. It's tricky with the art question, because in a way, the hero is kind of an artist.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to make him not an artist, because otherwise, as an artist friend of mine said, the whole novel would just describe a day at the office. You know, this is what artists do. I mean, they recreate the world. the pianist who he hires to constantly practice the same passage of Rachmaninoff and make mistakes all day long, round the clock. I met this guy once, this sad cellist, and he was just so sad, and he was bald at the top, and he played the cello, and he seemed to take absolutely no joy in his music, and to be so gloomy, and this character just kind of stuck in my head. There's also, I've written a non-fiction book about Tintin, who is a, as some American blogger described him recently, some gay-ass European thing. I mean, he's not big in America, but although Spielberg's about to make a movie, but Tintin is massive in Europe, and it's these cartoon books that are incredibly sophisticated, or increasingly sophisticated. And in one of them, there's actually a scene where a pianist practices in a house all day long, and at one point he substitutes a cassette so that he can sneak out and bet on the horses, actually.
Wow, you ripped that off from Tintin.
Oh, right? I totally ripped it off from Tintin, yeah. But, I mean, Hergé will have ripped it off from somewhere else.
Sure,
it's a set of, you know, set of borrowings. So that's where that scene comes from. But it's true, he is the only person that offers any form of resistance. And it's a kind of passive resistance. I mean, one phrase that keeps coming back in the book, actually the hero says it, is I should prefer not this, but I should prefer that. And that's a kind of, you know, little cute...
Bartleby, like,
exactly,
you know.
It's Bartleby the Scrivener, who's the perfect model of passive resistance. He just refuses to copy, in fact. And when asked why, he just says, I should prefer not to.
The other thing, actually, a lot of people have made comparisons of this book to Ballard and numerous antecedents, but I actually wanted to ask you about, given the number of colons in this book, it actually seemed to me, a sort of inversion of the Graham Greene formula. Whereas you have a Graham Greene novel where he goes, a British expatriate, goes off into another country, this protagonist is very much an expatriate in his own country. And I'm wondering how the colons came about. Was Greene a kind of influence?
Or? No. No, I mean, I've kind of read Greene, but I'm not really big on him. I mean, I love Conrad. I had a, you know, when I was a teenager, I kind of learned half of Heart of Darkness by heart. I was just absolutely obsessed with this book.
Yeah.
And Greene's always seemed to me like a kind of, you know, like on Amazon, it says, if you liked this, you might also like this. Like, you know, if you like Conrad, you might also kind of like Greene. That's a bit mean. I mean, he's, anyhow, but he is, yeah, the hero is a foreigner in his country. He comes back to, I mean, not just in his country, because it doesn't matter that it's set in the UK. It could be pretty much any, you know, develops any Western city. But he comes back to even the most banal and quotidian of daily events, like his neighbour putting out her bag of garbage on the staircase. He comes back to that as though he were a stranger or a Martian, an alien, you know, watching the most incredible and significant ritual, and he analyses every minutiae of how, you know, his neighbour holds her back, how her arm swings as she puts the bag down, how her eyes turn as she looks to him. So that is very, I mean, it's, you know, it's what Deleuze says, you know, the writer should come to his own culture like a foreigner, or Rambo says the same. I mean, it's a kind of quite classical trope of poetry, come back to the normal as though it were not normal.
Gotcha. I also wanted to ask you about how you stumbled upon the $8.5 million figure. One could look at the eight and it's tipped over, it's essentially the infinity symbol. There's that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the fact that you also have the car going in this figure eight.
Yeah.
And how did the eight kind of make itself aware, very much like this crack in the wall, or?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, the eight is a figure of infinity. It's this sort of infinite repetition, and there are so many, right from the moment where he gets the phone call to say he's got $8.5 million, and he turns so violently away from the wall that he breaks his telephone, has to go to a phone booth, and he moves through the streets in a kind of eight. At the party, he moves through the rooms in an eight, but there's always this kind of offset bit to the side, the remainder, the half. I don't know. I mean, you know, once I smashed my knee up, and when it reset the kneecap, there was this little bit floating around, this fragment, this leftover. I was never good at mathematics, and you never know what to do with the fragments. You know, you want to make it fit in, and I mean, I gave my hero the same problem with his knee. There's this, and when he thinks of the half and the 8.5 million, he thinks, oh, I would have been better if I just got 8. What do you do with that half? You know, and the whole book in a way is a way to just fit back that extra bit into the perfect figure. And in the end, the world becomes matter itself, becomes, you know, the remainder that can't be fits back in.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I wanted to ask you about the solicitor who appears late in the book, which actually a lot of reviewers have not actually caught on to. Which
you mean the counselor?
The counselor, sorry. Where he essentially is there, and he never actually says you. He keeps referring to the protagonist as he. This seemed to me very interesting in light of the fact that the protagonist is very much about I. He refers to my building.
Yes, my homeless person, my pianist.
Yeah. So, I mean, this kind of proprietorial nature of pronouns and the like and tenses. I mean, was this kind of fitting in with this idea that there are no individuals and if you go down this particular road? Or
The protagonist is I. He's only ever I. And as you say, everything is, where's my liver lady? Where's my reenactors? I remember reading an interview with Charlie Watts, the former Rolling Stone, the Rolling Stones drummer, and he tells this story that once in some hotel room, Mick Jagger turned in and said, "Where's my drummer?" And Charlie Watts turned around and punched him and knocked him out. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
The short counselor, who may in fact be a hallucination, as you say, he always talks about him in the third person. He did this, he did that. And the hero likes this because it makes him passive. It makes him the sort of not the person who's doing stuff, but the person who's being observed, being described. This whole fantasy of kind of being passive, being kind of observed. This is this brilliant story by Kafka called The Burrow, which is narrated by some mole or something who's built this underground burrow. And he's just obsessed with the safety of his burrow, and has he hidden the entrance well enough? And to make sure that he's hidden his entrance well enough, he goes and spends whole nights outside the burrow, where he's in full danger of predators, to look at himself being safe inside. He feels safer outside looking at the safe concealed entrance than he does inside. It's a total paradox. But it's this fantasy. I think this is what all of David Lynch's films are about, actually. Trying to look at yourself from the outside and the kind of the ultimate psychological impossibility of doing that, the pure psychosis that ensues. So the counselor refers to him in the third person. It also comes from Julius Caesar. He never says I did this, I did that. It's always Caesar. Caesar conquered this. Caesar went here. It's kind of heroic historicizing of it.
Weed
oh yeah, the, you know? Yes, that's weed. It, yes,
yeah. I mean, there's that aspect too. I mean, if I had to choose between, I think the royal weed is terrible, but this is even more terrible to actually be there in the same room with somebody and say he.
He. You know? Roland Barthes by Roland Barthes is in the third person. He wrote his autobiography in the third person. I love that.
James Ellroy frequently refers to himself in the third person.
Right.
So there you go. The color blue crops up quite a lot in this book. The liver lady has a blue cardigan. There's the Blueprint Cafe where they actually meet. So, in fact, I think blue is just about almost the only color in this book. So.
Blue, the blue goop. Well, Vintage here have a beautiful cover for it, which is just endless blue goop.
Oh, there's blue on this hardcover I have too. So
yes, it's true. I hadn't made the connection with the Blueprint Cafe, the blue liver lady. I just love the color blue. I mean, I love blue, and that's probably why it's there. With the blue goop, there's a scene which is kind of the heart of the whole book, even though it's the most trivial scene in it, where all this, the windscreen wiper liquid from his car reservoir disappears, all this blue goop, and this is a fantastic moment for him. It's gone up, it's become sky, it's just vaporized. I wish the world would do that. And then he switches on the ignition and it gushes down all over his knees, and he has the scene reconstructed and reenacted round the clock with a cast of 100 people replacing each other, and tries to find a way to make this blue goop kind of go up and become sky, transubstantiate, as he says, using it to the cosmos. Later, of course, he's doing it with people. He puts them in an aeroplane with a bomb on it, so that it will kind of dehiss and just evaporate. And I mean, as I was saying earlier, you know, the two axes or directions in this book are simply up or down, you know. And I mean, at the back of my mind, you know, it's not a kind of philosophical novel in as much as it's not, you know, he doesn't exchange ideas with the reader the whole time. But there is, you know, quite a classical philosophical schema behind it, which is the struggle within philosophy between, on the one hand, an idealist tradition, which culminates with Hegel, which is all about, you know, Aufhebung, making everything transubstantiated and sublime and killing the world in order to sort of have it as a pure abstract object or concept. On the one hand, the idealist tradition, and on the other hand, a totally materialist tradition that, you know, for me really reaches its zenith in the writing of Georges Bataille and his notion of base matter, base materialism, sort of messy, recalcitrant matter that resists the order of conceptualization and is just mess. And in Remainder, this is absolutely the two axes. He starts out as a Hegelian. He wants to aufgehobe the world. He wants to sublimate it, and it ends up gushing down and crashing all around him. And by the end, he becomes a good Bataille and says, "This is great. I love mess. You know, matter is what makes us alive."
So there's two trajectories, up and down, and also a philosophical sort of flip-flop from all across the spectrum, then.
Yes, yeah, exactly. He starts wanting to go up, and he ends up jubilantly hurtling down, which is kind of what precedes the beginning of the book, something falling from the sky on his head.
Yeah.
There's a kind of loop that, I mean, even at the end, as he's blowing up all the planes, he's saying maybe a bit of detritus will land on someone and leave me an heir, you know.
We haven't touched upon one of the funny conundrums of this book, and that is Nas constantly looking up words on his phone, where the protagonist could very well have just grabbed a dictionary and looked it on his own. There's also this obsession we were talking about with time and perfection and the like. So I'm wondering if you set specific rules on perspective as you were writing this, or were they kind of innately there as you were?
They just kind of suggested themselves. I mean, someone in his mindset where he's got, you know, this Time Control UK, this kind of concierge service to the nth degree that will organize, he can outsource almost every logistical aspect of his life to them. Why would he bother looking something up if he can just say, look this word up? Or by the end, he just raises his eyebrow when a complex word comes up and Naz types into his phone and Naz's backup people in some office look it up in a dictionary.
I'm sorry to interject, but what he remembers too is exactly the amount of time it takes for Naz to actually go ahead and fulfill a request, and that's also part of the...
Well, and the space it travels through. The first time Naz does it, he's got his cell phone out and he's texting on it. And the hero has a very clear kind of vision of the message going up to the satellite and down to the office and then up to the satellite again, which, you know, starts him tingling again because he remembers the moment of the accident of something falling from the sky. So there's this very, you know, he's always aware of the kind of, geometries and spaces that information travels through.
Why was it this particular perspective, however, over, say, something that was actually specific in definition? Or was this a restriction you set early on when you were actually creating this narrative?
There are some terms that are very important to the book because they're kind of like, you know, in a Rubik's Cube, there's the universal joint in the middle. Yeah. It's this kind of thing that turns and relates all the other angles and colors to each other. There are kind of fulcrums in the book, universal joints. And some of them are linguistic. So, for example, the term speculation is vital, you know, because it manages the whole cosmic register about stars and astronomy with the movements of capital, which is very important to him, with the whole idea of, you know, desire and imagination to speculate. And that word really needed to be teased out and have all of its different meanings stated. And that had to be dramatized. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's boring if he just goes, did you know, dear reader, that the word speculation means this, and this? So it kind of makes sense that someone would just do it for him. So even at the level of language, which is, of course, the way that you experience him as a reader or as a writer, he's covered in logistics. You know, he's this manic logistic event that never stops.
Going back to this tingling, which we haven't even touched upon, how did this kind of come about? Because it seems to me a very, really bizarre idea to just tingle in relation to something. I mean, it's very, very, almost like a sort of internal electricity that is very,
totally.
very, it reminds me very much of like the, you know, the old surgeons of like, you know, how they often believed that there were certain sorts of galvanizing bolts running through the body and that kind of thing.
When I was reading about trauma, I read Freud on Trauma, who is very, very good, and I read the kind of the anti-Freudians, the empirical positivist, you know, proper scientists who poke pins in rats' brains and things and see how they react. And amazingly, it's the one thing that they completely agree on is trauma. And for both, as I was hinting earlier, trauma instills a propensity to repeat, to return to the traumatic scene. And scientists, when they do laboratory experiments of rats, and, you know, if they push a green button, nothing happens. If they push a red button, they get a severe electric shock. They'll go back and back and back to the red button and press it, even though they're intelligent enough to know that they're going to get the shock. And scientists couldn't work out why, and then they kind of took blood level readings or something from it and realized that they're getting a more endogenous opioids are being released in the system each time that the trauma moment's repeated. So perversely, the subject's actually getting a hit, which is like taking drugs. I mean, it's a physical sensation. Freud says the same in a more sort of psychological way. You know, there's a pleasure. Traumatic repetition is about pleasure. So the neurotic, in repeating this sort of, you know, the disguised scene of their trauma is pleasuring themselves. And that's absolutely what my hero's doing. He's every time he repeats, he gets this drug-like tingling, which makes him feel fantastic. But like any junkie, you know, it's not so good after the first few times. He's more, stronger, yeah. More, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in light of the fact we were talking earlier about how this is sort of an allegory, to some extent, of fascism, and how Naomi Klein's most recent book, The Shock Doctrine, for example, now argues that, like, well, the entire populace is being shocked. There's Operation Shock and Awe. Yeah. So as a metaphor, it's almost as if you were kind of prescient to some degree.
Well, I think my hero is the perfect subject under capitalism, basically. He's the loyalist loyalty card holder there is. he gets his card stamped by whatever chain it is, you know, more often than anyone else, you can bet. In a way, he's enacting the neuroses that, I mean, I sound like some sort of Marxist professor here, but it really is the case. He's enacting the neurosis that neoliberal cultures, you know, instill in every subject who inhabits them. He's just enacting them more. He's kind of taking them to their extreme levels, I'd say.
What remain after everything's been washed away? By the rain, we will stand up bright as we stand today.